This is Randy Morris, April 21st, 1995, World Dreams.
A few minutes, then it seems like everything's a high point, you know, but life is life, and so it goes. Well, before I start, I want to make a couple of announcements, and one is that I have some handouts up here. One of them is an outline of the talk that I gave myself this morning, and which you may or may not hear tonight, but I did write it out in sort of note form, and so you're welcome to get that at the break. I also have an article here by James Holman, a short three-page article called A Psyche the Size of the Earth, and it's probably the most succinct statement I've been able to come across now on the whole topic of eco-psychology. It's actually the introduction to Theodore Rozak's latest book, A Reader on Eco-Psychology, and it's really well done. I also have an announcement because Theodore Rozak is coming here to Seattle on Saturday, May 20th, and he's going to be doing a thing called Many Voices, One Earth, a Northwest Conversation on Eco-Psychology that should be really good, and here's a flyer for it for people who are interested. I also have up here a copy of an essay that I recently wrote that I'm going to refer to a couple times. It's called Beyond Despair, an Imaginal Odyssey into the Soul of Hiroshima. And so I have some extra copies up here, and people are welcome to get them when the time comes. So, as Sherry said, I'm coming today mostly out of my identity as an educator and not as a clinician, though I've been working clinically since about 1986. I really want to speak today out of education and out of the educational imagination. And I had an experience that is the kind of mantra that I use whenever I think about what it is that I'm doing when I'm educating people. And it happened on a Easter morning, and it was a very nice day, and I woke up to the sunlight and heard a voice, and the voice was that of Mother Teresa. And Mother Teresa came to me and she said, "You know, Randy, the point is not to save people. The point is to create the conditions for the possibility of grace. To create the conditions for the possibility of grace." Now, while I think that's also a good description of what happens in the analytic encounter, it's also, I think, what is best happens in an educational encounter as well. And so what I'm hoping to do today, since we're talking about world dreams, we're going to be talking about the voice of the earth and how that voice appears in dreams and in synchronous phenomena, I wanted to start with that image of creating the conditions for the possibility of grace. Another way of saying it is create the conditions for the possibility of having a synchronous experience tonight. That is, something happening to you that you couldn't possibly have anticipated. Some idea, something that someone says to you, something happening around this topic of world dreams that you couldn't possibly have anticipated. And so to assist in that process, remember I'm coming at this educationally, I'm going to start by asking you all to do something. And what I would like you to do is to take a moment and introduce yourself to a person sitting near you who is not the person that you came with tonight. And I'd just like to take just a couple minutes doing this. I've been to a number of Jung lectures, and I've never seen this done before, and I've always thought it was strange that there would be somebody sitting here and then all these eyes focus this way and none focus this way, you know? And since what we're trying to do is create a learning community here so that I'm the facilitator and not the expert, so I can withdraw that projection. Thank you very much. I wonder if you all would indulge me in this particular exercise. Just for 3, 4, 5 minutes, just take a moment, introduce yourselves to a person you don't know, and maybe say something about what brought you here. Maybe there's an idea, something caught your eye, something sort of might have happened to bring you here. So let's just take a moment and do that. Don't be shy. I'm sure there's a lot of nervous people about it. Just do it. Okay, let's take just another minute here. Finish up. Okay, so if we can finish the sentence you're on now and come back to the room. Okay. So, apparently there was no lack of things to say. That's good. That's good. Okay, well, I want to say a few words by introduction of what brings me here. I got a call from Paul Fedorovich asking me if I would be willing to give a talk here. Apparently, Sherry told him that I was working with Jungian stuff. And he asked me if there was any possibility I might be able to bridge a series that they were having, first on the nature of dreams, and then a series that they wanted to do on the natural world. And I thought, oh, well, sure, that makes sense. Do we have some seats for these folks? Okay, great. I thought to myself that that makes perfect sense because I just finished this essay, which is up here, on Hiroshima, an imaginal descent into the soul of Hiroshima. And I have to say that I've been working on the theme of Hiroshima and the nuclear dilemma, if you will, for about 12, 13 years now. And I can sustain that gaze of Hiroshima for short periods of time, but I have to say that I'm really concerned about it all. In fact, I find myself, after working with that theme for very long, a tremendous weight, and I have to stop and put it aside for a while. And, you know, this comes from living in Hiroshima for 3 years, of always assessing where I am in relation to Ground Zero, of speaking to many hibakusha, the A-bomb survivors, seeing many people, sort of disproportionate numbers of people with scars and keloids on their bodies. My first day in the Peace Park, I went to see the mounds and the shrines and came to this one beautiful mound about as big as this room, maybe half again as large. And I go, oh, that's pretty. You know, there's some incense there where you could stick the little jaw sticks. I said, well, what's that? And my friend turned to me and he said, oh, well, that's the burial mound. There's the remains of 30,000 people under there. And so when I begin to work with imagery like that and really allow myself to sink down into it, I experience a great deal of grief and of despair. So when Paul called me, I was still in that. And I realized, well, if I had to talk about anything, I'd have to talk about world dreams. Because the question that arises out of Hiroshima, as it does out of the AIDS crisis, as it does out of the environmental crisis, is what's going to save us? Now, you know, I'm an old hippie, so it's a miracle we've lasted this long, in my opinion. So you have to understand that I have that temperament anyway. But, you know, sometimes I speak on behalf of people who sort of have these feelings but can't quite say them, that really, how are we going to get out of this? The World Watch Institute, Lester Brown's Institute, says, well, we have about 16, 17 years before irreversible damage to the environment. Car bombings in Oklahoma City. Nuclear proliferation, you know. And just with these images, we can just start to descend down into our despair and grief. And so the question arises, what's going to save us? I read recently a great essay by Thomas Berry in a book called The Dream of the Earth. He talks about the difference between cultural guidance and genetic guidance. And cultural guidance is when we have a particular cultural mythology that has within it a kind of healing sense of it. So that, we're having oppressed workers, so Marxism has something to offer the people around that. Oh, we're having some problems over here. Here's an ideological system that can solve that problem. Now, Thomas Berry's thesis is that the problem with our problems today is there is no cultural response to them. There is no known cultural response to what's happening. So we're in this cycle. We have ideological systems, but they're not working. They're breaking down. What's going to come in with the new idea? Where is the new myth going to come from that's going to wake us up into something that we can't possibly anticipate? And I would say that that force is the unconscious. Whatever the new myth is going to come out of the unconscious, because where else could it come from? And so when I think about world dreams, I think that world dreams are the voice of the earth speaking to us in unexpected ways that we couldn't anticipate, that are trying to get us into some new way of thinking, some new thing. So paying attention to those dreams, listening to what they're trying to say, and then, above all, taking moral action in relation to what's being heard seems to me of critical importance. So World dreams are a form of genetic guidance coming from deeper places than the ego. And so what I want to be able to talk about tonight is, what are these things and what are they saying? A world dream, then, is a kind of voice of the earth that's heard in our dreams and that requires and demands of us a certain moral response. Now, my approach comes out of the liberal arts. And most people, when they think about the liberal arts, think of, well, that's where you get like 18 credits of natural science and 20 credits of literature. And, you know, that's a pale facsimile of what liberal arts is really about. It comes out of a tradition. That particular image comes out of 19th century German universities. The way that I explain what was coming out of Germany in the 19th century is a story that Henri Corbin tells. He talks about a time when the Temple of Jerusalem was burning. And the priests are up on the top of the temple, and the flames are kind of licking up, right? And they know they only have a few moments left. And the chief priest has the keys to the temple. And just before the whole temple is consumed and implodes and these people die, the chief priest throws the keys into the clouds, into the heavens, and this huge hand reaches out and grabs the key and pulls those keys into the heavens. Okay. So that after the burning of the Temple of Jerusalem, the story goes, the task is to find the keys. Okay. So this is the Grail myth, right? Find the Grail. Find the keys that will let you back into the temple from which you are now exiled, because there's no temple anymore. It burned. You're in exile from the temple. But if you can find those keys, you can get back to the temple. Now, the problem is, come the 17th and 18th century, the rise of the mechanical philosophy and the death of alchemy and the imagination. The very idea that we were in exile and that our spiritual task was to find the keys was lost. As Corbin says, we were now in exile from the very idea of exile. And we lost the notion that there even was a spiritual task. So that by the time the liberal arts are formulated in 19th century German universities, it's completely secularized. And so all of our academic language, the traditional things, sociology, anthropology, none of them contain a transpersonal element. They've lost the very idea of a spiritual quest. And so when I think about the liberal arts, I like to go back to farther than that, at a time when the world was still alive, the anima mundi, the soul of the world, was still speaking. So I like to go back to the school of Chartres Cathedral, 12th century, a time when the Virgin Mary was becoming a cult and the feminine was coming back into the culture and the warrior class was alienated from the feminine, and so the feminine's now rising up somewhat like it's doing today. And so these great cathedrals are built, and the School of Chartres Cathedral is started. And in Chartres Cathedral, there's one door, a huge door, that has the seven liberal arts on it. And the liberal arts was understood as an inner path of development. And the whole point was, it took you 7 years to go through the seven liberal arts, a year for each liberal art. And when you're done with that initiation of 7 years, you're ready to go into the world to do the spiritual work. So the deeper esoteric tradition of the liberal arts says that this is an inner path of development. Its purpose is to transform the soul so that the soul can do the work of the world and respond to the needs of the world. This is the tradition I like to speak out of. Interestingly enough, each of those liberal arts had both an ancient philosopher who represented it. It had a planet that represented it in terms of archetypal deities, and it also had a spiritual form itself. That is, rhetorica was a being, a spiritual being, and part of your work during that year was to get in touch with a spiritual being that was rhetorica or musica or arithmetica and have them speak to you. So you didn't just learn from the people who were the masters of the school. You also learned through the imagination, and the imagination would come and speak to you and tell you things you couldn't possibly know. So from this point of view, I like this title. I work with it again and again, from James Hillman's book, 100 Years of Psychotherapy and the World is Getting Worse. You know, it's a great title. It's the problem of narcissism, right? We get into our problems so much that we forget the world's need. And so I'm not saying the psychotherapy that you shouldn't do that, but it's always a means to an end, in my view. But if we think about education the way I was describing it, we could equally say 100 years of bad education and the world's getting worse. Because where can we learn about the nature of the transformation of the soul? Do we have to go to the institution of psychotherapy and analysis to get it? I would suggest not, that there are other forms of doing it. Now, one of the big debates going on in higher education right now is the whole question of deepening democracy. It goes by different names, multiculturalism, the search for democracy, enlarging the concept of democracy, right. What's at stake here is what constitutes knowledge anyway? Is this monolith called the Western tradition the only source of knowledge? Where else can knowledge come from? And who's in charge of knowledge? And who says what knowledge is? To me, it's a very profound debate. I think its shadow side is political correctness. So I would not recommend that when this subject comes up with your friends at the dinner table over a beer or something like that, that you call it just political correctness. I would suggest there's something much more deep going on there. And it has to do with who's in charge. And has to do with formerly oppressed viewpoints being given a voice. And this is grounded, supported by Jung's statement when he said, absolute truth, if there is such a thing, will only be heard in the concert of many voices. Absolute truth, if there is such a thing, will be heard only in the concert of many voices. So, as you can imagine, in higher education, especially in a fairly liberal place like Antioch, being a white male trained in the Western tradition, I've had my share of interesting conversations. However, I am solidly behind the notion of multiculturalism and allowing people to speak out of their experience. And it's fully consistent with Jung's view of individuation. The way that I like to think about this is a quote that comes from David Miller's book, The New Polytheism, where he says this: the experience of the loss of a center is indeed frightful at first, whether sensed by a culture or by an individual person. Okay, this loss of a center, the center of value, it's really a 20th century phenomenon, okay, started by Einstein's insights into the fact that truth seems to be relative to the position of the observer. But after the fright passes, Miller says, one notices a new sense of liberty. How everywhere one stands is a center. How everywhere one stands is a center. A new center. And the universe of meaning is not limited to a tight little horizon, a vicious circle of a single mind and lifetime. Today we have a real sense of the hermetic meaning of the horizonless circle without boundaries and limits. We have only yet to notice that this experience applies to God and society, self and universe, in such a way as to imply that when the center is everywhere, it is in fact multiple. When the center is everywhere, it is in fact multiple. Everywhere a person stands is a social and psychological center. Okay. Now, this is a crucial statement because on the one hand, it says that anything I have to say here tonight is not privileged. Okay? It's not like I'm an expert who holds things that you don't have and you're somehow going to get it from me. Okay? It also means that you're a psychological center and you have things to say to other people and to this topic here tonight that nobody else can say. Everywhere one stands is a social and psychological center. No particular position is privileged. Everybody has something to say. And so at Antioch and in our program and in my teaching, it seems to me that one of the key pieces of work is to empower people's voices. We have to hear more points of view, because as long as we hear from people who espouse themselves to be experts, we're only hearing one point of view. We're only hearing a one-sided assessment of things. So just think about the Myers-Briggs typology, right? The whole point is to move to the center. We need each other. We need Hispanics. We need blacks. We need these people to see what reality looks like from their point of view, because we don't have the whole picture. Okay. So tonight I'm giving you my perspective on things, but it's not a privileged perspective, and my hope is that by telling some of my dreams and stories, that something will be triggered in you that you had either forgotten or didn't value before. And if I'm doing that, then I'm doing my work. My point is not to fill your head with ideas. Okay? I do want to share some dreams with you, and I also want to make a disclaimer when I do that. It's always risky telling a dream in public. And when I work with people, I recommend that they not tell dreams that they haven't somehow themselves thought a great deal about and have some sense of it. Okay? On the other hand, these dreams need to be told in some ways. And there are dreams that, I mean, it's not like you need to understand every dream before you tell it. Sometimes the telling mirrors and then you understand it by telling it. But in any case, telling a dream in a public place like this is always a little risky. And what I would like to ask you to do is just bracket the whole notion that it's saying something about me personally. Now, obviously it is, okay? But you don't have enough information to know what that is. What I'd rather have you do is think about these dreams and these stories as being of collective, that something else is speaking them through me. Okay? So that's a bit of advice around that. I also want to emphasize something I said earlier. It comes from a dream that Russell Lockhart had in his book Psyche Speaks. He talks about having a dream in which he was reading memories, dreams, and reflections. And this little bookmark fell out and kind of fluttered to the floor. And he picked up the bookmark and read it. And it said, in a poem-like statement, it said, "A dream wants a dream, a poem wants a poem." Okay. Best response you can have to a dream is to have your imagination come up with an image. Okay? So a poem needs a poem, a dream needs a dream. So as I'm telling these dreams, I'd encourage you to pay attention to your reactions. Okay? Now, we're also, since we're moving into storytelling time, this is really weird walking all over this thing. Since we're going to be telling stories, we also need to get into a little different space. Okay? So I've been doing concept stuff here. We need to get back into the heart a little bit. And so I'd like to invite you to do something. And it requires you to make a little noise. Okay? So... basically, we're going to make the sound ah. Okay, ah is the sound that opens the heart chakra. Okay, so just so people won't get too self-conscious, we'll just start by just saying it a couple times on your own. Just ah, 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 ah. Okay, good. You're not as hard on audience as I thought you were going to be. Actually, it was really good. Okay. So what I want to do now is do it together, okay? And so I will do one by myself and then invite you to just join in with me. It's just a little meditation. You may want to close your eyes if you feel comfortable doing that. We'll just do it four or five times. It's no big deal. We're not going to be zoning out here for the next 10 minutes. Just a few, and just see if you can't feel that resonance. No, I wasn't supposed to. See if you feel that resonance down here. Okay, I'll do it once and then you can join me. So imagine, if you will, a 4 or 5 year old boy in his bed late at night, fall night, The wind is coming off the desert into this town and whipping around the corners of the house. Outside there's a big maple tree, and the maple tree is swaying like this, and its branches kind of brush up against the windows in the house. And when a car comes around the corner, its headlights flash against this tree, and the shadow is projected on the wall. And the kid's in bed going, like this, freaked out. Shadows are doing things, and they're moving. And shapes are taking place. This kid's scared. And as he's sitting there in his bed like this, he sees a kind of light in the room. He can't quite figure out where it's coming from. He looks around like this. It's kind of a gentle glow. And then he turns his eyes to the foot of his bed. And there on the foot of his bed is an angel. Glowing, golden light. It's just like an angel that he's heard people talk about. It's got wings, you know, and it's got a halo, and it's kind of glowing there. And the boy doesn't know quite how to feel about that, and is kind of nervous, you know, but nothing bad seems to be happening, and he realizes that the light is doing something to him. It's kind of taking some of the tension out of things, you know, and he's feeling a little better. And then the angel turns its face like this and looks at the boy and just nods and turns its head back like this and resumes its watch. And with that gesture, the boy is completely relaxed. He hangs in there a little longer because he knows that this is kind of an unusual experience, and he'd really like to remember this angel, but then he falls back to sleep. Well, this same kid, who, of course, happens to be me, later, in his late 20s, realizes he's about to take off for Hiroshima. He wants to have a cross-cultural experience. And Hiroshima, well, why not? He can get a job there. And besides, the nuclear thing's up these days. You may remember the early 80s, Ground Zero, right, and all the little things. And it might have something to do with the fact that his brother-in-law is a colonel in the Army in charge of nuclear and chemical warfare targeting, you know, and maybe that's piquing his interest. But in any case, he's getting ready to go, and a month or two before he goes, he has this dream. And in this dream, there's a table, and on the table is this large nuclear bomb. And I'm one of about three or four people in white coats. And the clock is ticking. 10, 9. And we're sort of working over this little box that's got these wires coming out, you know. And we're working very carefully, very carefully, because we don't have time to make a mistake, you know. Very carefully, we're pulling things, and it looks like we're going to get it, okay? And talks to the clock in 5, 4, but, you know, I think it's going to work all right. We just need to take this thing right off here very carefully. 3, 2, just this one last thing. 1, 0, and the bomb explodes. And in the dream, I've seen all the films. I know all about it. First, there's the flash, you know, that sort of puffs up your skin like this and causes it to peel. And then there's this huge blast of wind, and it just takes all the skin off of you. And as the skin begins to shred on your body, you're wondering what's going on. And then that's the last thing consciousness can remember. So I'm asking myself, well, this is not a very optimistic dream. Not to mention the fact that I'm scared shitless by it, right? But anyway, that's the dream that I took to Hiroshima with me. And so I had my experiences in Hiroshima, and this picnic that Sherry referred to is called a Peace Picnic for Future Generations. And, you know, there's a lot of political activity from all over the world in Hiroshima. It's really, they call themselves the City of World Peace. And but I noticed I'd been reading this book called The Fate of the Earth by Jonathan Schell. And I was reading it actually on this Buddhist reliquary that overlooks Ground Zero. You can see the city down below. I describe it in this paper. And I come to the section in The Fate of the Earth in which he says that, look, whether we have children or not, the fact now that nuclear weapons exist and can be used at any time means that now we are in charge of the future of the Earth. That Hiroshima has humanized the eschaton. Eschaton, your notion, your image of how the world is going to end. It's humanized. Before, only God could do it. But now humans can do it. They can end life as we know it on this planet. So whether you have children or not, what it means is that we're all parents of future generations. Okay? Because future generations can only exist if we exercise our responsibilities. If we don't, future generations won't exist. There's a great book called This is the Way the World Ends. And in it, the spirits of the unborn people take the last seven people on Earth down to Antarctica and put them on trial for the human race. Okay? Those are the spirits of the unborn people because we screwed up. So what we thought was, well, look, we have all these peace things. And why don't we just have a peace picnic for future generations and just go over to Hijiyama where there's this graveyard and a play field nearby and just have a good time and just celebrate being human. And so so we did. It was kind of an interesting experience. Anyway, I come back and I have another dream. This dream took place just before George Bush was elected president. And I thought that campaign was particularly vacuous, you may recall. And I have a dream in which I'm at the United Nations, and there's a big party going on. And people are sitting at these tables, all these dignitaries and stuff, and the party is interrupted for just a moment because there's going to be a little speech by someone who wants to honor the fact that a UN soldier has recently been killed in the line of duty. Still going on. And so the party sort of, the volume goes down, and the dream camera kind of focuses on this picture of this young man and his family. He's got a wife, a couple kids. It's kind of sad. Then the camera kind of backs up, and there's a couple more pictures of UN soldiers who have been killed in the line of duty, some men and some women, with their families. And then the camera backs up even farther, and it turns out that there's thousands of these UN soldiers who have been killed in the line of duty. And the place is starting to get kind of emotional, you know. And the people in charge of the party, they didn't mean it to get out of hand, but it's clearly out of hand now. And in fact, as the camera backs up farther and farther, and there's more and more pictures of these people who sacrificed their lives, the tears are streaming out of these people's faces, and the emotional atmosphere is really intense. And a man stands up from his table, a well-respected leader, and he says these words. He says, "We are all, myself included, held in bondage by forces we must begin to identify and break free of, that we must give form to and consume, that we must give form to and consume. The time is now for huge international shifts of consciousness." Then he has another line to the speech that I couldn't remember, but it's a real zinger, and everybody's just in tears, and people are just dissolving in agony and weeping. And then the lights go out. And when the lights come on, the music starts up, there's champagne coming out of the ceilings, the confetti's flying all around. The people in charge of the party had started up the party again, right? And I'm sitting at this table, and I'm going, "Now what's going on, you know? What do you think's happening?" "Well, I don't know. I don't know, but I think this is part of some larger lesson plan." So, then I have a dream. I teach a class every year on called Interdisciplinary Perspectives on Childhood. I think that children these days are serving as projective fields for the unresolved sexual and spiritual issues of adults in our culture. And I try to teach a course in which we can come to terms with what that's all about. And so I have this dream. And with it, I'm with a companion in this town. It's almost like a medieval town, except it's a modern town. But, you know, it has the bakery there and the butcher shop and the barber shop. And, you know, we're walking down the street and we just sort of strolled into town. It's kind of nice around there. And but we kind of noticed that it's kind of interesting because there's no kids around. I wonder what that could be. So we stop somebody. We say, "Hey, where are all the kids?" "Oh, well, they're being held by the giant over on the other side of the forest in the stockade." "Oh. Well," my friend and I start thinking about that. "Well, you know, that's not fair. They shouldn't be over. Let's go check it out." So we walk through this forest. And we get to the edge of the forest, and just before we sort of break into the open, we can see this huge stockade. And before we get into the opening, we can look up through the trees, and there's this giant. Must be 40 or 50 feet high. It's kind of, he looks kind of like, you know, kind of like a bullet head and kind of sloped shoulders, kind of like a doughboy. And we're looking at him like this, and by God, he's got something in his mouth. It looks like maybe toothpicks or something, but then we realize it's the legs of some children that he's munching on. Oh, jeez, that's terrible. This giant's eating up the children. We got to get him out of there, okay? Okay, so what are we going to do? Okay, well, look, I'll run out there. I'll open the door to the stockade. You run in there and break the kids out, and we'll try to get them into the forest and escape, okay? So, ready? Go. So, my companion jumps out. I open the stockade. He runs in. It turns out there's a couple old abandoned cars there that he can get one of them going rum, rum, like this, and he slams it into the gate and tears the gate down, you know, and there's some kids walking around in there. I said, come on, kids, we got to get out of here like this. But they don't look like they're in much of a hurry. And they just kind of walk on over like this. I said, no, come on, before the giant sees us, you know, he's going to eat us all. Now, come on. You know, and the kids just kind of walk like this. And I'm trying to push them along like this back into the forest where we're protected a little bit. And I go, God, what's the matter with you guys? You know, I mean, what's going on inside there? And this kid that I'm talking to says, well, I don't know, but that giant sure does run a well-organized place in there. Well-organized. Well, come on, we gotta go. So I'm going through the forest, and I figure I'll get to the village right on the other side, and then we'll get the alarm going, and we gotta break out, okay? And on the way, I get to the center of the forest, and there's this community center, and there's these state patrol officers walking by, and they're starting to walk into the community center, and I start to wave them down to get some help, and then I realize, whoa. Oh, wait a minute. Based on what these kids are saying, those officers might arrest me for breaking and entering. Oh, I better be careful here. So I kind of skirt around the community center, and then I think, I wonder what's happening back at the village. And then somebody comes up to me and whispers in my ear and says, the giant went to the parliament of the village and complained about what you've done. And I think to myself, man, there's more going on here than meets the eye. Okay. So, again, to remind you of what I'm doing here, I consider these world dreams, okay? This is not my ego stuff, okay? My ego stuff might be spread around through there. This is not about the completion of my ego. This is not about my shadow work. These are dreams coming from the earth through me. Well, dreams are not the only way in which world dreams come. They can also come through synchronicities. I teach in many of my classes about initiation. I think if I were asked, what's the single most problematic psychological problem of our time? And I would say the lack of initiation for our children. And so, having reached this insight theoretically before I reached it experientially, I felt like I needed to do something about that. And so I engaged in a series of four vision quests, called Vision Cries, out in the desert, pretty rigorous. And I want to offer one experience I had there. This particular year, it was very hot. It was about 105 or 106 degrees out during the day. It was miserable. And we did have water, but no food for 5 days. And I'm sitting in my circle, and, you know, we had to put these prayer ties around, and, you know, I've got a few things there. But I'm just sitting there in my shorts, you know, because it's really, really hot. And it's second day, and I'm sitting there, and I hear a voice, a very clear voice, and it says something to me. I go, oh, well, I wonder if that voice is real. I mean, I wonder if that was just like my wish to have something. Or maybe, you know, I wonder what the epistemic status of that voice was. You know, it's like, it could be, you know, anybody who studied phenomenology knows this can go on forever. But maybe it was a real, maybe it was an autonomous other voice. You know, maybe it was a spirit voice. But how do I know? How can I tell the difference? Blah, 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 blah. Okay. So I get up. And I start walking around the circle, praying in each of the four corners. And I get back, to the west side. And I sit down in the dirt, and I have a little scrap of paper and a pencil, and I'm sort of writing down a couple of these ideas. Well, I think as a result of my prayers, I've come to the conclusion that the voice contained certain knowledge. And I'm writing K-N-O-W, and I'm sitting in the ground with my legs up, bare feet. And when I get to the letter W of knowledge, I look up, and there about 4 inches from my bare foot is a 3-foot rattlesnake. And I'm very still, naturally. And this snake had come in through the north door of this circle. And while I was doing this, while I was, thinking about this, it was sitting there next to my foot the whole time. And so I go, and it continues on a little way, and then it kind of lifts its head and kind of looks at me like this. And then heads on out the west door. You should see it in my little piece of paper. The next words are, "Holy shit!" I thought it's a really good image for, bridging the worlds, right? The holy and the shit and the heavens and the earth. And it was that kind of experience. And so it's a good image for me of a kind of mental masturbation that we can do around sort of like, is this real? How long are we going to sit here in this paralyzed state of thinking about the epistemic status of something instead of acting on behalf of the voice? Now, there are other ways in which our world dreams, the voice of the earth, can speak. I want to give a couple examples. Others include the statements when you wake up and there's a voice and some words there. I gave you one where Mother Teresa came and spoke to me. A couple others that students have told me about. Here's one. Begin with a nightmare, end with a dream. Begin with a nightmare, end with a dream. Or this, I am fashioning a new motherhood of Christianity. I am fashioning a new motherhood of Christianity. Or this, the psyche is the womb of creation and she is in mourning. The psyche is the womb of creation and she is in mourning. Or a particular favorite of mine, being unhappy is being unfair to the world. The world wants its due, which is you in full. Being unhappy is being unfair to the world. The world wants its due, which is you in full. Between two places, maybe two villages, there's a kind of general movement of people, many people on the road. We hear of a dead whale beached in a cove. People say it's up ahead. We round a curve, and I see the long body in the shallow water. We all want to see it closer, and so we run. There's a man in a wetsuit, some kind of animal expert or worker, and we stand around as he gives resuscitation and then pronounces the whale dead. But even as he is working on it, there seem to be some signs of life. He leaves, however, as there is no hope. And then the eyelids flutter, and I hear a distinct cough. This whale is not dead. Then, to my astonishment and great sadness, the whale becomes simultaneously more alive and more like an Inuit Eskimo. He is weeping and asking to be saved. He's asking for mercy. His cries are heartbreaking. I see into his eyes, his dark, dark hair, into the curved palate of his mouth and teeth as he calls out in a language I don't understand. We are screaming for the worker to come back and help him, even as I move forward, trying to reassure him in his suffering that I will do something. What? I don't know. I have no skills for this. His tender flesh is exposed to the air. The worker expert comes back and gives me a withering glance, like, what did you think you were going to do? And I'll end with this one. We are at the Wailing Wall, We are asked to keep giving it away. That is good. I weep in agony. My friends have already died in fighting this battle. I don't want to give any more away. We are all just fuel for the fire. We must allow ourselves to be consumed. As we give ourselves away, life is renewed. The world is not so congested. I protest that the innocent are dying as quickly as those who are evil, but it seems to make no difference. We must all march, knowingly or unknowingly, into the fire. Life isn't toted up as we imagine. Good and evil are not the measuring units. Giving, emptying ourselves is what matters. Giving, emptying ourselves is what matters. So let's just be quiet for a moment and just, there's some images, okay? Let's see what the poet in you brings up in response. Let's just be quiet for a moment. Okay, so the question I have to ask myself in relation to these dreams and my own experiences are, what must the psyche in the world be like such that these experiences can happen? What must the psyche in the world be like such that people can have dreams like this? And immediately the point is made, well, the way the psyche in the world can't be is the way that we've been taught. That is Cartesian, dualism, secular, dead matter out there, res extensa and res cogitans. There's just consciousness and dead matter, right? That worldview can't account for these experiences. And so that worldview doesn't speak to me anymore. And the question is, where can I go to find resources that will help me understand what's going on here? Because whatever's going on here is the answer to my cry about Hiroshima. That is, what's going to come in and save us? Because it's looking pretty hopeless to me. But I tell you, as long as people are telling me dreams about this kind of stuff, there's a little spark left, you know, like a little spark of hope that there might be some new thing coming in. So now what I want to do is I want to turn to a few conceptual points. And I'll talk for about 15 more minutes and we'll take a break. And when we come back, we'll try to do some learning community stuff around your experience of this talk. Now, to switch out of sort of heart speak, to switch out of the imaginal mode, we need to do another kind of sound thing, okay? We're going up. We're going here. We're going up, okay? So so this one, we'll just sort of get us loose a little bit here. We'll do the oh sound. Oh, oh, okay? So we'll just start out and just do a couple. Oh, oh. Oh, okay. So I'll do one, and I invite you to join me. Oh. Okay. So let's go up into our heads a little bit. You know, I've been studying Jungian psychology for over 20 years and keep coming back to the same ideas. If I could just understand what an archetype is, you know? If I could just understand what an archetype, you'd think after 20 years I'd get it. Anyway, when I was thinking about, okay, so like what, how can Jung help us understand those experiences? I came up with like five ideas, okay? And since I only have about 13 minutes now to describe them, I'm real kind of quick. And that's because I'm not trying to pour my notion of these ideas into your head. I'm just trying to sort of awaken sort of something you might already know about them or something. Okay. First idea, psychic reality. Jung has a view of psychic reality that I think is unique in the 20th century and that restores the possibility that the world has a soul, that matter is not dead, but in fact has a consciousness of its own. How does he do this? Well, the dualism that 20th and 19th and 20th century thought is in is the matter-spirit dualism. Okay? So take the angel. Okay? There's really only two explanations. One is that it's a projection of my consciousness, my childish, you know, I heard a story, then his mom told me a story the previous night, or, you know, something that would account for a projection onto the end of my bed, and there it is. Okay? Or it really was an angel. That is, it was an angel with the same status as my bed, as this matter here, as my body. It's either that, or it's a projection of my fantasies. Okay, one or the other. That's the dualism. What Jung tried, an idea that Jung tried to revive, and I think did successfully, is the idea of psychic reality. That there's a third way. See, there's the soul. There's not just body and spirit, but there's a soul in the middle. And Hillman does a really good job of showing where in Western tradition that third fell out of things. He traces to the Council of Nicaea in the 8th century, where the three-part anthropology of body, spirit, and soul became a dualism of body and spirit. Soul became a part of spirit. And so the whole idea of soul began to fall out. Tried to be resurrected by the Romantics, of course, who said that these are not just figments, mere figments of my imagination, they are really real. But they were just the Romantics, right? And they were so, they're so emotional, you know? And so, anyway, Jung is certainly in the tradition of the Romantics, okay? That these are not mere figments and projections of my imagination, but like the spirit beings of the liberal arts, they actually come up and they have things to say that I couldn't possibly know about. That is, there are things in my consciousness that are outside of my ego which have things to say. And Jung's main statement about that comes in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, where he talks about Philemon. Remember, Philemon was this old wise man who came to Jung during his confrontation with the unconscious and began to speak with him and told him a whole bunch of things that he just had never thought about before. But yet, wait, it was in his imagination. So how could it be accounted that he somehow read these in his own experience somewhere and forgot them and they came up as a mere figment of imagination? No, it was really something else inside his consciousness. He writes, Philemon and other figures of my fantasies brought home to me the crucial insight that there are things in the psyche which I do not produce, but which produce themselves and have their own life. Philemon represented a force which was not myself. In my fantasies I held conversations with him, and he said things which I had not consciously thought. For I observed clearly that it was he who spoke, not I. He said I treated thoughts as if I generated them myself. Let me read that one again. He said I treated thoughts as if I generated them myself. That's worth meditating on. But in his view, thoughts were like animals in the forest, or people in a room, or birds in the air, and added, if you should see people in a room, you would not think that you had made those people, or that you were responsible for them. It was Philemon who taught me psychic objectivity, the reality of the psyche. Through him, the distinction was clarified between myself and the object of my thought. He confronted me in an objective manner, and I understood that there is something in me which can say things that I do not know and do not intend, things which may even be directed against me, that is, against the aims of the ego. Well, this is a very radical thought, and I can't begin to express how radical it is. But once you accept it, all kinds of things are released. And the way I like to think about it is the little people are restored to the earth. The little people. Because fairies, gnomes, you know, all those little people, they're not just projections of my fantasies in this view. They're really real, but not really real in the same sense that this is real, okay? That's material reality. They have psychic reality. So they have their own intentions outside of mine. They appear to me in my imagination, but they're not the same thing as body, and they're not the same thing as spirit. They're in between. I should say, at the last lecture I was here, I bought a book here called Demonic Reality over here. Its subtitle is A Field Guide to the Other World. And it has in it one of the best descriptions and most easily understood descriptions of what psychic reality is from Jung's point of view, and I'd recommend that book. Okay, psychic reality. It opens up the world of the little people. It makes my angel real. You see, it saves the phenomena. I really did see an angel. I believe it. Second idea, the model of the personality. Now, what Jung's, I mean, you know, we could go on forever about this, but the one point I want to make about Jung's model of the personality is that, unlike Freud and most secular psychologies of our age, personality is not a mere function of causality. That is, what happened to me since my birth is not the sum total of who I am. What Jung emphasized in his psychology was finality, or the telos, the purposiveness of the personality. That there are things happening in my personality right now that can't be explained by what happened to me in the past. They can only be explained at the end. See, they only have meaning at the end of things. And so if I use only a reductive mechanistic causality to explain personality, I can never get to a transpersonal worldview. Okay? All psychologies which use mechanistic causality are secular in nature. And if you're going to have a transpersonal psychology, you have to be able to admit final causes. Once you do, a whole world opens up, including the possibility that you are on a journey that that involves fate. Fate and destiny become viable concepts in understanding personality if you understand personality in terms of final causes. That, to me, is a key notion. Hillman talks about it in 100 Years of Psychotherapy, this whole notion of living life backwards, right? The matador who was a mama's boy and always clinging to his mother's skirts. You know, the Freudians say, well, he needs to compensate for that, so he'll become a matador and be a real brave boy, right, to compensate for his issues. Well, what if this kid somehow knew that he was going to be facing 2,000-pound bulls as an adult? You'd want to hang on to your mom's skirt, too. You see the difference? So you begin to look backwards and you can begin to see the fate in your childhood experiences of who you are meant to become. Now, the goal of personality, in Jung's view, is wholeness. That is, the personality is trying to create a sense of wholeness about itself. And the mechanism is fairly simple to understand. It's called compensation. That is, that there's the self inside of me knows what it is that I'm to become, just like the acorn knows what it needs to become. That's the genetic blueprint of my personality. But my ego, because it suffered all kinds of wounds, because of my childhood and who I was raised by, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, has gone astray. But the self knows the way it should be. And so it sends up dreams that compensate my conscious attitude. And so dreams are understood as compensatory. They're always trying to get you to come back to the center of things, you know. And if you stay away, then they'll start getting nastier and nastier until you can't stand it anymore. You go nuts. Then the dreams will just take you anyway. Okay? Because the personality is seeking wholeness. Okay, seeking wholeness. Well, an interesting concept emerges out of this, and it's not talked much about in Jungian circles, and that is, what happens when an ego is relatively well integrated? You see, as long as you're sticking in the clinical model, the whole function of your work is to get your ego completed, right? You got to integrate that shadow stuff, you know? And so, well, when you get your shadow integrated, more or less, see, it's never complete, right? It's always more or less. Well, time to leave therapy. right? But the whole question remains, and I think Jung is the only one to deal with it adequately, is what do you do then? Okay? The question really becomes a religious question of the personality. That is, what am I meant to do? What is my vocation? What does God want of me? What is my final cause? What is my telos? See? And then you're starting to work with people who are just normally neurotic, like all of us, right? Just normally neurotic. I mean, what are they supposed to be doing? Well, see, you can hear where the world dream's going to come in. Well, what they need to do is, turns out, people that I've talked to have worked with a lot of people like this, that what tends to emerge is relationship. The dreams become less compensatory, and they begin to have these images of relationship to the world. The world begins to sing a song, and you can begin to hear it better as your shadow is more integrated. Okay, let's see. Third idea, archetypes. Well, my understanding so far is archetypes can be understood as a priori patterns of energies, right? Patterns of energies that can appear either behaviorally, you can see them being active behaviorally, or they can appear imaginally as images in dreams, etc. Now, and of course, we always get into the argument about whether you're seeing an archetype or an archetypal image, but I think the best way to understand archetypes to me is to understand them as energies that are coming up. Jung refers to them as bits of nature. Because Jung understood on that mountain when he was looking in Kenya over and seeing the herd, the wildebeest moving through and just being into that timeless sense of realizing that human consciousness is an expression of nature looking at itself. Nature looking at itself. That's our unique heritage. That's our bit of nature. We can actually see ourselves in the earth. Okay. Only human beings can do that. We are a bit of nature and we're looking at nature. Very interesting paradox. Anyway, so archetypes come from nature and they appear to the ego as somehow separate from us and yet part of us. Now, in Jung's early formulations of the archetypes, it's very easy to see how he thought of archetypes as being in us. They were instinctual energies that were in my organism and coming up and causing, there was a causal relationship between my behavior and the expression of these archetypes. Later, in his work, he began to see the real implications of what it meant that the archetypes were bits of nature, because he started talking about the psychoid nature of the archetype, that the archetype is both an expression of matter and of spirit, of matter and consciousness at the same time, so that the archetypes were coming out of nature into us. In other words, the archetypes are not in us, we're in the archetypes. Archetypes are not in us. We're in the archetypes, and we're all subject to these energies that are flowing between and amongst us and then also appear through us in our consciousness. Very interesting idea. And Jung was only formulating it near the end of his life, and I have to say he formulated it very badly. Jung is completely opaque in his understanding, in his expression of synchronicity. There is a book that I found that finally clarified some things for me by Robert Aziz. It's in the bibliography that I put at the back, called C.G. Jung's Psychology of Religion and Synchronicity, and it's the first one that has been able to penetrate my head. Okay, so what happened is, by talking about the psychoid nature of the archetypes, how we're in the archetypes, Jung began to move the world into an unus mundus, a single world now of consciousness and the world. This allowed him to talk about synchronicity, understood as the inner and the outer as threads of one weaving. This is Russell Lockhart's phrase. I really like it. Inner and outer as threads of one weaving. So how could it be? How could it be that when I'm writing the word knowledge, a snake is 4 inches from my feet? I mean, what are the chances? You want to compute those? You know, what are the chances of that happening? Well, what's going on? You know, what's going on when that happens? Well, Jung says synchronicity. And the idea is that in a moment of synchronicity, I have a very strong emotional reaction, but I haven't the faintest idea what's going on. You ever notice that? You have a synchronous experience and you go, oh, that's a synchronous experience, but it doesn't mean anything. It's like completely opaque, you know. It's just there, but you don't know what I mean. But you have a strong emotional reaction to it. Okay. So what the synchronicity is, what's happening there is your conscious world is merging with the consciousness of the environment in which you're living. And the two of them come together into the unus mundus, the one world. And what happens is this. Through that, the intentionality of what's around you is announcing itself to you. But the ego can't comprehend it yet. So you can't really understand synchronicity until you begin to see a series of synchronous events. And if you see the series of synchronous events, then you can begin to see your own fate right before your eyes. Because there'll be this pattern will begin to emerge, and you'll begin to see the way in which the world is dreaming you. The only way you can understand that concept is through bridging spirit and matter in a way that our normal language doesn't allow us, which is why it's hard to make myself understood around this particular subject. Okay, last idea. The voice of the earth, the soul of the world. So, in that psychic reality, what happens is that psyche is not just in me. Psyche is in matter as well. And because psyche is in matter, it has intentions. It has a consciousness. It wants things. It desires, just like I desire. So does the world desire. Okay. Now, the images in which the desires of the world appear are very specific. And you can see them in some of the dream examples that I related to you. That is, what the world wants is very ego-specific to my consciousness and to yours as well. Okay? So it wants something, and it wants something of you. Okay? No time to be depressed. The world wants you, which is yourself in full. And basically, what a world dream does, speak the voice of the earth and provides images of divine service for the redemption of the earth. Because it wants something, see? The earth is trying to compensate itself through you. So it's suffering. It needs something, and it's telling you what it needs. Big problem, of course, is a moral response. Because, as we know, dreams tend to just rise up. Oh, I had a really cool dream last night. Yeah. What did it say? Well, it said I should go do this. Well, what are you going to do about it? Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, you mean have the dream make a difference in my life? Yeah, you might think about that. Well, but if I do that, everything's going to change. Nothing will be the same anymore. Everything will change. That's the moral problem of dreams. We allow them to rise up. They seem to be saying something, but we have no will to respond to them. Usually because we don't have the courage. You may have noticed the number of dreams in which suffering was a key. You know? The problem with doing what the dream says is it hurts. Now, the alternative, of course, is to follow the same trajectory we're going now. And while things seem to be going well now, it's really going to be interesting to see what happens in 25 or 30 years. Okay? To see whether it would have hurt more to do something in relation to your dream now or whether it hurts more 30 years from now. You know, but we all know the psychology of delayed gratification and how powerful it can be. So, I think I'll conclude by reading a poem. And I make no claims to being a poet, by the way. However, I think poetry is really God's gift to the earth. And I find it very useful in helping me get some things that I wouldn't ordinarily get. So start with a little dream phrase and just sort of let it go and see what happens. So I make no claims to this being anything except an honest response to something that Earth wants of us and of me. It comes from the end of a dream that I had in which I was riding on this boat and there was kind of a tall ladder, about 8-10 feet, kind of like a lifeguard thing, and I was sitting in the top and I was going, and by being up high, I could see down into the ocean much better. I could see deeper in there. And I realized that we were going through this area where there were all these mammals swimming. There was a killer whale there and a porpoise over there, and I was going, God, these are really pretty animals. And then just, and I fell right off the thing into the water. I go, it's like, I could feel these kind of slimy bodies going by me. I go, but it didn't look like they're going to eat me up or anything. I go, well, okay, just relax. And that was the end of the dream. So I wrote this poem, Falling Amongst the Animals. Falling amongst the animals of the deep tides, I flounder in fear. Alien waters of salt close around my head, and the sound of muffled clicks and beats last heard while snuggled against mother's warm and giving breast. Fear transforms when pain stays its hand. The creatures gather round and prod, intent upon some larger labor, though play too has its place where light meets water and worlds invert. Gathered up, a galloping band we make, man carried once more on shiny backs of creatures oft butchered. In forgiveness as boundless as their ocean home, shame is shed like green waters from slick backs, replaced by joy and love, for these bind man to beast in ways known by few. And so we fly where water meets sky until a shore we spy. Long gray stretch of rock and sand where bears and seals do lie, expectant, for we are known here and portentous events await our arrival. Soaring heart protects its molten core. My sea friend rears up, and then I spy a screen a mile wide. And there, too, amongst the rocks and cairns, the curved shore, a teeming, breathing mass of life, like the animals, lie the animals of God's green earth, silent as they witness the unfolding scene. The rumble begins, the slow tempo of death and power. Ripples form up from below. Vertebrae a chill, the liquid lines of fear race up and down. The screen flickers, and there it is, the revelation of God. The mushroom cloud, God's blazing design to make us free, to make us whole, to make us think anew. Compassion for all beings is being revealed at the twilight of an age. Bathed in eerie light, outlines of ancestors departed, souls of the unborn, animals, plants, and minerals crying to be understood, deep pools of blood, fuel for the fire. My eyes, soaked with revelation, seared by the pain of neutron scars, the fear of unredeemed lives, the knowing of future generations, turn to my fellow witnesses. The animals turn their liquid, loving eyes to gaze at me. Disenfranchised, they turn to one with voice. Turning, they look to me. My eyes, soaked with revelation, seared by the pain of neutron scars, the fear of unredeemed lives, the knowing of future generations, turn to my fellow witnesses. The animals turn their liquid, loving eyes to gaze at me. Disenfranchised, they turn to one with voice. Turning, they look to us. So those are the words I have for you tonight. And I'd like to take a break, and when we come back, we'll form some learning little communities here and see sort of what's coming up and talk to each other about it, and we'll come back as a group and talk as a whole. Let's take about 10 minutes, if we could.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CGU and Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.